sheltered I had been and how protected, because I was used to people saying, like, this is how you do this, instead of treating teaching someone something as a threat to like I would get better at it than them and then edge them out. It was a really intense scene, and really all we were doing was picking fish up from people to shuttle them to the cannery. So at the end of that season, I had been raised to think that I could do anything, and because it was the free to be you and me generation that I, you know, and I got on the plane and I was just like, okay, that was awful. I failed, but I am going to come back and I'm going to go fishing. And I had always held that in my mind. So when I got done with college, and then I was an English major, so I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I waited tables for a while, and in the middle of the winter after my first year, I was like, okay, I'm going fishing. And I got a second job to help pay for my plane ticket, and I got a drive away. I drove a Mazda RX-7 up to Seattle in 1990 and walked the docks for 3 weeks in Kodiak and slept in my sister's van until I found someone who was desperate enough to hire me. And that's how I started my deckhanding career. I don't know if that's, you know, that's more about how to get a deckhand job. And then being a deckhand, I worked 9 seasons consecutively as a salmon. And then eventually I fished halibut my first year. I fished salmon, mostly seining.
And what is seining?
Seining is a form of fishing where you use a boat that's anywhere between 32, I think it's maybe that's like a, I worked on a 32 foot boat. They're very small, to 58 foot boats in Alaska. That's the limit that you can have. And you have a very big net that's about 30 feet deep and maybe a quarter of a mile long with the lead. It's all measured in fathoms, so the mileage is all roundabout. It's 250 fathoms net with a 50 fathom lead. And then so you have this huge net that hangs vertically in the water, and then on the other end of the net there's a skiff, an open boat that operates the other end of the net, and these two vessels operate in tandem to create a trap, and it makes like a giant comma in the water, and the fish, you park the net, the fish are coming, traveling up the shore, you park the net either with the skiff or the boat on shore, and you stretch the net out, and then you curve it around, and you're dealing with the tide pushing you and the winds blowing you around, so you're dealing with all these forces, and then over the period of half an hour, you eventually bring the net into a circle and then slowly draw a line or a rope that runs through the bottom of the net into like a drawstring bag. So you close the bottom of the net, hopefully trapping a whole bunch of fish. And that is what purse seining is, because you make a purse in the water. That whole, and then you bring it on board. And so you have two deckhands on board who, using hydraulics, separate the net into neat piles so that it comes off. Uses a lot of equipment, a lot of machinery. It's an expensive fishery. When I was fishing, a net minimum amount that you would pay for a net that you built was $10,000. And that was, you know, 20 years ago. So fuel has really increased. It uses a lot of fuel. But it catches fish in what we call a really clean way. The fish come on board, they're alive, they're not strangled in any kind of net or ropes or hooks or anything like that. And anything that you catch that you don't want, you can just pitch it right overboard and it swims away. Most species do. Or, you know, you could get sharks, you know, things like that. So that's seining. And I did that for herring and for salmon. And I also fished cod. I did a couple of winter seasons fishing crab and cod in pots. I fished cod by jigging, which is lowering hooks into the water. Wow. I've long-lined halibut, which is when you lay miles of line along the ocean floor and the hooks with bait on them attract the halibut, and then you let them rest for a little while, and then you pull them up and you haul these enormous fish, you know, 200-pound fish, like bigger than you, that kid, and that. It's a wild existence. It's pretty, you know.
Do you still do it?
I got hit by a car in 2007 and got severe, or in 2010, and got some really bad whiplash, and so I couldn't. I've been working on fixing my neck so I can go back, but I probably you know, once you get out of the loop, if you're not actually a skipper and own a boat and are doing it all, it's hard to be a 46-year-old deckhand.
Yeah.
Just, it isn't even the work. I mean, it's nice to, I like working outdoors. I like working hard with my body. But it's just the disruption of your life. And, I mean, I have this life now here in Portland where I'm here all the time. But I really do miss living in the wild and living, you know, with a circadian rhythm that's in tune with the planet rather than the alarm clock, mm-hmm. you know. But I was fishing 6 months a year when I stopped.
Wow. Yeah. So you have written about it. You've been part of the Fisher Poet Gathering for mm-hmm. For its entire
yeah.
existence.
Mm-hmm.
And you have been making these zines.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're going to be talking about is an audio zine, and maybe explain to people what an audio zine is.
Well, my first experience of an audio zine was a zine called Life During Wartime, which was made by Rebecca Gilbert and Aaron Yankee. Aaron Yankee works here at KABU, and Rebecca Gilbert started the Independent Publishing Resource Center a long time ago in the late 90s with Chloe Udaly. And it was a zine where they interviewed people about different aspects of punk rock experience, and then later branched into, I remember collecting some interviews for Aaron during the WTO up in Seattle, and they released them on tapes. They were hard to find and awesome to listen to, and used a lot of technology that I didn't, and you know, like, now, Aaron has helped me make a few audio zines, which is really just a CD that doesn't, I guess I called them audio zines because I made them the way I made my zines, where I just sat down and said, oh, here's a little story about this song or story, and then I would read the piece onto the digital equipment, and I recorded them all here at KABU and just put them out myself. With some, you know, some help from Stumptown did some of the printing, and my friends did the art. Just like I make a zine, and this, I like the title zine because it's kind of anything you want it to be. It mm-hmm. isn't a book. It isn't a magazine. It isn't a documentary. It isn't a television program. It's its own thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this story that this audio zine is about happened in 1997, and why did you want to revisit it?
Well, Aaron and I were talking about, if you know Aaron Yankee, you know that one of the things she loves to do is just, she loves to make things all the time. She's always working on projects. And I've been friends with her since I moved to Portland in the late 90s. 97, I think, and 96, 97, I started coming around here, and she just is like, you know, and the project could be something as simple as like a really exciting, extravagant birthday party for a friend that has all kinds of costumes and soundtracks
pinatas.
And pinatas, and, you know, so she was like, let's do a project, and we sat and talked about something that we could do together that was something that I hadn't done before. And I had, when I was traveling, when I was more of a migrant worker, I used to travel with a big old JCPenney tape recorder. And I would tape record sounds and people talking and things that I thought were weird. And I've saved those tapes for 20 years, and I have no idea. I had no idea if I would ever use them. And I mean, I have these crazy radio stations or radio conversations that between fishermen I recorded in the middle of the night. And I remember I recorded some ducks once when I was up in Kodiak. We were feeding my friends ducks, and we recorded the ducks quacking. And then I heard some fishermen kind of arguing on the radio when I was out fishing. And we keyed the mic and played the ducks back onto the, so it went out over the air. And so all the fishermen got to hear all these ducks quacking in response to their fight. So up to that point, that's all I had done with them. And I said, you know, Aaron, I have all these recordings. And it turns out one of the recordings I had was from the 4th of July. And I said, you know, I've always wanted to rewrite this story, so it just stood by itself. And it didn't, because it originally was published in Extra Tough number 3, which was all about the season I spent beach seining, which was like Persini, except you live on the shore and you pull the nets in partially with the help of a skiff and partially by hand. And so your intake of fish is very limited to what you can physically handle. And so instead of like 30,000 fish or pounds of fish, you get maybe 2,000 pounds of fish is a big day. So Aaron and I put our heads together and we said, well, she said, you know, I can do this thing. You can write the story so it stands alone. We can digitize these sounds. We can place them throughout the story and we can write a grant so that somebody can help us do all this financially and we can make a beautiful cover. So we initially conceived it as a project to which we could, that might be fundable with a grant writing process. And then our grant was accepted by RAC and we were awarded some money. So we, you know, we got our grant information on the 21st of December and the zine was done on the 16th of February. So we really turned it around.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And the story is about this bear that gets killed, a Kodiak mm-hmm. brown bear. And we thought that to kind of give people an idea of what Kodiak brown bears are like, we'd play a little from the audio zine. Great. And maybe you could set up, as they say, set up this little bit that we're going to play.
I interviewed four different men that were involved in this bear killing in different ways. And one of them was, except for the fish and game guy, was just our local expert. He's a very respected biologist. He's probably the man who knows the most about Kodiak brown bears in terms of experience. He's been working with them for over 30 years around Kodiak. His name is Larry Van Dale, and he's a PhD, but he's also really approachable and loves the bears and is really into educating people about the bears. And I was so honored that he wanted to talk to us and be on the zine. And I told him, I was like, you know, I stole your bear facts and published them in my zine back in 1997 or 2001. And he was like, that's what they're there for. You know, he just is really into making sure people know about the bear. And he's also very humble and kept saying, like, there's no experts on the bear. Where you're going to learn is from the bear itself. And his goal seems to be to educate people about the bears and remove the myths and surrounding them and the miscommunication that seems to have happened over the centuries of bear-human interaction.
And so let's hear that little bit from Larry right now.
We've got about 3,500 bears on Kodiak, the best we can figure. It's a little less than a bear per square mile, and these are all the big brown bears that we're talking about. Specifically on Kodiak, brown bears are a very important resource for a lot of different reasons. The bear is a very important animal as an iconic species and as a part of the ecosystem, and we want to make sure that those bears are there just for their own purposes, not just for human purposes, and for the importance to the ecosystem of bringing marine nutrients into the system, for instance, then spreading the dead salmon carcasses around in various manners. And another part of that is the cultural aspect. Bears have been an important part of Alaska Natives' culture for millennia. They're a special species that, in effect, is a liaison between the spirit world and our world here on Earth. And we want to respect that aspect. A lot of hunters would like to have one as a trophy and are willing to pay up to $25,000 for one of those bears. The other aspect of bears on Kodiak is people see them as an important resource for bear viewing. They'll come and see them in the summer primarily on places where they congregate, salmon spawning streams and so forth. And that too can be a consumptive use, like hunting, if people don't do it in the proper manner, you know, if they run the bears off so the bears can't get whatever food they need and so forth. So our management program, as I say, has three primary components. It's the hunting aspect, the viewing aspect, and that respect for bears aspect. We have a very controlled hunt. We kill about 180 to 200 bears a year in the hunting season. Then we allow people to kill bears in defense of their life or their property, and property has to be something that's important for sustaining your life. It can't just be your fishing rod or something like that. So in those defense of life or property, or DLPs, kills. We have roughly 10 to 20 of those reported a year. And if truth be known, it's probably twice that many. So maybe 20 to 40 bears a year that are killed in defense of life or property. That is about a 20-year average. The past several years, we've had much lower kills than that. These big animals are trying to make a living, and part of their living is to get as much food as they can so that they can sleep all winter long. And if they're going to have an easy way to get that food, they're going to take advantage of it. And an easy way to get food is to get it from people when people leave it laying around, be it fish or a cooler or garbage. And like big dogs, if they learn they can start getting food from people, they're going to continue to keep trying to get it.
That was Larry Vandale.
And that was Larry Vandale. Mm-hmm. And he was speaking on an audio zine that Mo Baustern produced along with Aaron Yankee. It's called Report from Uyak Bay. And that's a little bit of an interview. You also interviewed, I'm not sure how many years later, the person that actually killed the Kodiak bear that you're writing about, that you're talking about, that you're telling the story about, which was quite interesting. And I would love to ask you, if we have time, about how it was to revisit this with people, how it was to get people to talk to you about this. But first, we want to talk about the events so that we don't ignore those. There are several events celebrating this audio zine coming up, Mo. So how can people experience some of what we've been talking about?
Well, we're really excited. We've got a whole week. We kind of conceived of it as a local tour, which is kind of a little bit of a joke. But yeah, we're visiting three separate neighborhoods in Portland. We'll be at Slab Town, which is on the corner of 16th and Marshall in Northwest. It's in Northwest. Slab Town Bar. It's a bar, but for the event, it will be all ages, and we're making bear hats, and we'll be listening to the zine. So it's a bear hat making and listening party. It's called Bear With Us. And you can come to that for a couple of hours, 4 o'clock to 6 p.m. We'll have materials. You can bring materials. And there's food at the bar you can purchase, or we might end up having snacks because I don't like to not have snacks. So that's this Sunday, the 16th.
From 4 to 6.
4 to 6 p.m. at Slab Town Bar. And then if you bring your bear hat Thursday night, if you bring your homemade bear hat to the Jack London Bar in the basement of the Rialto Pool Hall between Alder and Washington on Southwest 4th, it's 529 Southwest 4th at 7 o'clock. It's a night of storytelling all about bears, and it's just going to be spine-tingling. There's some really good storytellers. Vanessa Rennick, who's a local renowned filmmaker, Judith Arcana, my friend Tim Griffey, who, if you know him and hang out at barbecues in Portland, he's a great storyteller when he gets started. He's been fishing commercially since he was in his early 20s. I will be telling a story. And Laura Lee Messersmith-Glavin, who grew up in Kodiak and fished commercially and is an ESL teacher here at PCC, she will also be telling a story. All great storytellers. $5, 7 o'clock, Jack London Bar, obviously not all ages. And then our final event.
And that's Thursday. This is coming Thursday, March 20th.
Thursday the 20th.
Okay.
And then the next night is at 7 o'clock at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street, is a bear-themed variety show. It's called Grin and Bear It. The bear storytelling event is called Bear Witness. Grin and Bear It, next night, first day of spring, March 21st, coming out of hibernation, all kinds of variety acts related to bears. And it's going to be really fun and funny. There's a one-man band, there's dancers, there's jokes. But it also, I just, not to get too academic and pointy-headed about it, but it is a way to look at how interwoven humans are with bears and how much bears are a part of our life. I mean, part of the presentation at the variety show is going to be from the queer scene and where bears are in queer culture, because there's a whole subset of queer culture that identifies as bears. And
wow.
So it's just skin. And that event is also all ages, 7 o'clock. And they're Yeah, please
that's
come.
That's a week from today.
$5 for that one, too. Suggested donation.
That's Friday the 21st, the first day of spring, at the Independent Publishing Resource Center. Those are three very wild-sounding events.
Yeah.
So I think that sounds great. So before we end, we just have a few minutes left, talk a little bit about what it was like to reconnect with the person, for instance, who actually killed the bear in this incident that you talked about.
The man's name is Travis Cunningham, and what's interesting is I never met him in 1997. He was one of two young men who was up there working. They were up there working for a guy who was building a lodge, and I met his buddy, but I never met him. And it was actually unexpectedly moving, and it made me homesick for Kodiak. To reconnect with this story and go through it and edit it and rewrite parts of it and think about that. And the thing is, I interviewed the guy that I fished for a family that summer. I was fishing for this woman, and her husband was the first person I contacted for an interview. And then I called the other guy, Harry Dodge, who had helped skin out the bear, and he said, you know, I've got Travis's phone number. And so I called him out of the blue, and he immediately said, I'd love to. I emailed him, and he wrote back. He was like, I will talk to you any night of the week is fine. And then he just told the story straight up, and he's living in northern Minnesota or central Minnesota. He's an HVAC repair guy. He's got a couple kids. And when he tells the story, it's very moving.
And he remembers it. It obviously was a very...
He says he thinks about it every day.
Yeah.
And I believe him.
And how about other people talking to you from Kodiak? How was that an ability to get people to talk to you about things?
I was really kind of surprised, because in my experience of doing this zine since 1996, I've tried to get people I've worked around to give me interviews. No one will ever talk to me. I've had to come up with a strategy of I write down a story and then I publish it, and then somebody comes up to me and says, you got it wrong. This is how it actually went. And that is how I get people to talk to me in Alaska, which is kind of how you get people how to teach you to do stuff in the fishing industry, in my experience. So I was really surprised when people were very open to talking to me. And then later, it seemed to come from a place where Alaskans in the last 10 years have seen their own personal image and self identification is being taken from them by reality television, because The Deadliest Catch is presenting this idea of Alaska that is not what they identify with. It's not why they moved to Alaska. It's not why they live in Alaska. And I mean, Larry Vandale said they had 8 different reality shows trying to land and shoot on Kodiak this summer. And the state of Alaska is providing all kinds of incentives for tax and commercial incentives for people to come and film in Alaska. And the people of Alaska are scared they're going to lose what they have. So I believe that's why everybody was so into coming forward, because they knew that I would tell, they trusted me. And so this is a really precious zine to me, and I'm really excited to send it away to them.
Well, Mo, I want to thank you very much for talking about this. There's so much more that we could talk about, and there's so many more issues that are touched on within this zine, things like gentrification and other issues. They're very interesting. So I thank you for that. And if people want to get more information on the events that we mentioned, how should they? I know they can get it on KBOO's website.
You can get it on KBOO's website, and you can contact me at mostofeverything@gmail.com. You can just send me an email, because I make zines, and I make them with paper and glue, so I am not I don't have the technology at this time.
That's okay. So most of everything
at gmail.com.
Great. Or go to kboo.fm.
Or you can go to the IPRC website to find out about their event, or the Jack London website, or you can get in touch with Slabtown. All those organizations have them listed on their calendars.
Great. Thanks again. Again, the name of the audio zine is Extra Tough 6.75 Report from Uyak Bay by Mo Baustern and Aaron Yankee. Thanks, Sam, for engineering. This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. Stay tuned for Moving On.
Thanks, Kathleen. Yeah.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 12 noon. Coming up is Moving On with your host, Don Jacobson, following the KBOO news headlines at noon. So stay tuned.
The Triangle production, Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at The Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at The Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.fm under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Friday, March 14th. My name is Kristen Yount. Michigan became the ninth state to pass the so-called rape insurance provision. A Right to Life petition initiative placed the controversial policy in front of the Michigan House, which passed it last December. The bill prohibits insurance companies from offering insurance for abortion as a standard feature, so women will have to purchase additional insurance to use in case she needs one. The additional riders are cheap, costing companies that choose to offer them less than 50 cents a month. But because teasing out federal dollars from Obamacare coverage specifically for abortion is difficult, no insurance companies offer separate riders for insurance, meaning that states like Michigan have made it impossible for a woman to cover herself. The policy takes effect this week for anyone purchasing new insurance. For those insured now, the change will take place when they renew their policies. A well-known Chinese human rights activist has died from tuberculosis and liver disease after being denied care while she was in custody. Authorities arrested Tiao Zhengli back in October. She had gone missing after being prevented from leaving the country to go to Europe in September. Aged 52 at the time of her death, Zhengli staged a two-month sit-in in front of the foreign ministry, asking the agency for more transparency in human rights reporting. She specifically wanted more public participation in the drafting of the National Human Rights Report. Despite having tuberculosis and end-stage liver disease, she was denied parole. She died after being moved to a hospital on February 20th. Yesterday, the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing regarding the U.S. State Department's report on the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. Four witnesses gave testimony. Two of those witnesses were voicing opinions against the pipeline: climatologist James Hansen and Sierra Club executive Michael Brun. The two proponents of the pipeline included both a current CEO and president for the Chamber of Commerce's Institute for the 21st Century and a past president and CEO of that institute. The president of the Jones Group, James Jones, listed his role as the Jones Group as an advisory and strategic counselor, counseling governments and businesses on both national security and energy security issues. He did not reveal that he has been consulting for the American Petroleum Institute. The group spent $22 million lobbying for the Keystone XL pipeline. Jones served as President Obama's national security advisor in 2008. Environmental groups are asking that Jones disclose his client list before any further testimony in front of lawmakers. A hunter shot and killed an Oregon wolf in Idaho. The wolf crossed into Idaho by swimming over the Snake River. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife tags wolves in an effort to track the progress of the Oregon Imnaha pack, which was reintroduced to the state in the 1990s. The hunter shot the wolf legally because he had a state-issued tag from Idaho, which allows for hunting wolves. Over 900 wolves have been killed in western states since 2011, when they were taken off the endangered species list. A startling 260 wolves have been hunted and killed in the neighboring state of Idaho since tags were issued at the very end of August last year. Following news of the hunger strike by hundreds of non-nationals being held in a privately owned prison, President Obama called for an overhaul of immigration policies, hoping to make them more humane, as a stopgap measure as Congress continues to fail to pass immigration reforms. The Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma collects a daily bounty from the federal government for detaining immigrants, and that is where the protest began. Strikers are demanding better food conditions and to not be forced to work for a dollar a day, which is the present policy. Also, a national campaign called Not One More Deportation has asked Obama to halt all deportations. On Thursday, the United States government and British Petroleum struck a deal about offshore drilling. The agreement lifts the 2012 ban on BP's ability to ask for deep-sea drilling permits. They were banned from pursuing permits because of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010 that had devastating results for the Gulf Coast. The EPA will require a special audit to make sure that BP complies with all safety regulations. In return, BP will drop its lawsuit against the United States government, specifically the EPA. That's going to do it for our headlines today. Please tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news brought to you by dedicated volunteers from our Southeast Portland studios.
This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Aladdin Theater, presenting an evening with Arlo Guthrie, Wednesday, April